So my name is Aviat Tabori. I'm talking to you from Alon Shvut in Gush Etzion in Israel. The time here is 8 o'clock p.m. And it's my pleasure to be able to start this series with you, hopefully for the next few weeks. This series is, before we actually explain what we're doing, from the judicial reform to war in Gaza, religious and halachic challenges, it's called. But I want to just mention that today's shiur and the entire series is dedicated in memory of Rona and Natan Katz, Razel Bat Binyamin, Vitova Riva, Zichron Livracha, and Yeshua Nachman Ben Chaim Yitzchak by their children, Barbara and Aubrey Abrams, Michael and Ilana Katz, and Brian and Hannah Katz. May we be blessed with good health and long life. I just want to mention that amongst the people that I just read out now, Michael and Lana Katz, who are my uncles, is my uncle's sister. So, a bit of mishpacha here, and always good to have a little shout out for mishpacha. Okay. So in this series, we are going to discuss and learn together certain halachic matters that are connected directly to the events occurring in Israel, specifically in the past few months. As we all know, as we're all, I'm sure, very much aware, I don't need to tell anyone, the past year here in Israel has been a roller coaster, very, very dramatic events taking place in Israel. And I'm not talking only about the war, but of course, what happened before the war. We find ourselves in the past year moving very, very, as if quickly from a situation of much tension and between the Jewish communities here in Israel, many demonstrations, as you're all aware, demonstrations after demonstrations, which had to do with a big debate, which got out of hand here in Israel about whether or not the legal system and the judicial system should be changed and how much it be changed. This has been a matter of dispute for many years, but it broke up the past, it exploded, one can say, in the past year or two, in the sense that it created huge rifts between communities, divided the Jewish people here in Israel into groups where, as weeks went by, it reached very, very high levels of tension, which many people feared would actually lead to to bloodshed even. I mean, people were that concerned that chas v'shalom, these tensions would lead to lo aleinu some milchemet achim. I'm not a politician, and I have no intention of talking about politics. I'm trying to describe the events without taking right now a stand. And if I do, between the lines, say something that one could somehow do a diuk, and I have no intention. I'm really just trying to explain the situation rather than to take a certain side in this argument. It's not my point at all today, but rather to describe the events. And the truth is that these questions of how, whether or not State of Israel should have what type of legal system should we have, of a judicial system should we have, how much power should the courts have? These are questions that go back to the beginning of the State of Israel, where one could argue that the reason why this was never really decided completely was because we never had the real opportunity to do so. In 48, Israel found itself straight away, right after the declaration of independence, into a state of war. There were attempts during, especially in the beginning of the state, to establish some kind of constitution. There were a lot of arguments, which type of constitution, who would write the constitution. There was a decision at the time in 48 that a constitution has to be written and should be written, but it has never been done. And till today, Israel does not have a constitution, which therefore leads to many areas where it's not very clear what the legal system is, what it should be. And that really gave room to all these arguments that, as I said before, exploded the past year or two in as it was a big debate in the Israeli community. I'm just gonna, today we're gonna focus more on that, and in the next few weeks we're gonna move from this discussion and into the current events of the war, and maybe even try to connect both events. But in today's shiur, I would like to discuss whether or not the Torah and Halakha can somehow live in peace with the values of democratic values as we know them today in the Western world. This is a well-known topic. I do not believe I'm going to bring many, many chidushim today, but I would like to somehow mention the main points of argument and discussion that come up in this very sensitive matter. The main question, of course, is can a religious Jew, an Orthodox Jew, who believes in the authority of the Torah and the Kadosh Baruch Hu, can he really live in peace as if with a modern democratic liberal world? One could argue that, well, outside of Israel, it's not so debatable, because outside of Israel, one can live in his home the way he wants to, and klapei chutz, and when he leaves his home, he has to obey the laws of the land. Dina d'mchuta dina is a very, very famous idea that we have to obey the laws. The Rebbe's Gemara talks about this. Shmuel's famous halacha that we have to obey the laws of the land. And really, Jews debated this issue throughout their existence in the Chutzarts, but it was never really debated when it comes to building a Jewish state. Building a Jewish state really suddenly confronted us with this existential question. Should the state of Israel be a state of Torah law? And obviously, because it cannot, because the majority do not want it, and the majority today in Israel are secular. How does a religious Jew, as if, live in a world where he's in some kind of conflict between the state of Israel and other values, especially democratic, liberal, Western values that we have? And I, as introduction, just want to claim something very, very clear and very simple. I think it's all clear to everyone, but I think it's important. And there are three different kind of groups here in the state of Israel that, and only one of them, of course, has an issue with this matter. In the Haredi community, so I would say that the Haredi community in some way is very similar to Orthodox Jews living in Chutzarts. Because in Chutzarts, in diaspora, it's really not threatening you, because you can live your life as you believe it, and you have to deal as if with the government, you deal with the government. That community is not really threatened or bothered by this question. Obviously, the secular world, and it's in a secular world, of course, wishes to accept secular and liberal views that and principles that exist in the world, and also are not really threatened by Judaism's values that, as if, seem to contradict or not the world of their worldview. It is, of course, the religious Zionist modern world, which, of course, is threatened, is challenged with these questions. It's really this community that consistently asks itself, how does it live with these values together? And therefore, I see myself as a religious Zionist Jew, a religious Zionist modern Jew, and therefore I find this matter an existential challenge here in Israel. And now, as if maybe after 75 years, where we have been able to establish a state, and now we can say, okay, what's next? Maybe this is the time that we can ask these questions and debate about them. So as a beginning, I want to claim the following. If we were to ask, can Orthodox Judaism live together with the values of democracy? I think the answer is probably a yes, but before we say the yes, I would like to say in what way we cannot. In what way is there a default in the relationship or the connection between Judaism and democracy? And for that, I would like to quote Rav Lichtenstein, who, for those of you who know Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, he for sure would be a person that we would all, I think, is an example of a person who of a Talmud Chacham who lived in the world of Torah, but also lived in the modern democratic liberal Western world and saw the importance of that world. I would like to quote him here in the source sheet in front of you. You can read it to yourself as I'm putting it on the on. Hopefully, you can see it on your computers. Rav Lichtenstein here gives us here a very, very profound message, I think, which is a frum Jew, first of all, has the authority of God, the authority of Kadosh Baruch Hu. If in the liberal, modern, democratic world, the authority are the people, and that is in the kind of the most important factor in society when we talk about democratic values and how we look at authority. So a firm Jew, of course, cannot accept such an idea because a firm Jew accepts that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the main, the only authority. He says it very nicely here. We, on the other hand, you can read it yourselves, please, but I'm just going to read the last line here. We, on the other hand, said Lichtenstein, and I refer to those who cleave to universal religious values in general and to our worldview in particular. I mean, he's not just talking to what we would call a Haredi Jew, right? He's talking to people that believe in people that are, we would call modern Orthodox, highlight the idea that the source of the authority is the Holy One and His will. He is our God and there is no other. So that already suggests that there is a default problem or challenge that a person who believes in the Torah, believes in Kadosh Baruch, who believes in the light, in the world of religion, of being a religious Jew, and by default cannot just say to himself, well, I accept all universal Western democratic liberal values, because by default our authority is Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that is the beginning point which I feel is very important. I want to just mention something. I don't know the crowd in front of me so well, and I have to be a little bit careful what I say, how I say, because I don't know exactly how things are taken. It's much easier to say things when people understand where I'm coming from. But I will say that there's sometimes a certain kind of pressure that we feel that automatically we have to kind of accept all other values that are out there in the modern world. And I want to dafka begin by saying that as firm Jews, I think the beginning point is that we recognize and we understand that Kadosh Baruch Hu is our authority. And after we can, as if, make that claim and explain why there's a default within accepting all other Western values, after we claim that claim, we can now begin arguing why it is true to say that many of the values that we today meet and confront in the Western world, why many of these ideas really go back to our texts, to our principles, to our ideas, to our mitzvot. Why really there's so much in the world that we live in the world of the Western values of democracy, why many of them really do connect directly to our mitzvot. And after I make that claim, I would like to go through a few examples trying to prove, to show, to highlight why many of the values today that exist in the Western world appear already in our sources many, many years before modern democratic values were mentioned by the great thinkers of this topic. So first of all, I would like to go back to the source sheet. And I would like to begin this with a chapter, two psukim in Sefer Shoftim. In Sefer Shoftim is called Sefer Shoftim, while Sefer Melachim is called Sefer Melachim. In Mitum you have Shmuel, but it's very clear from the name Shoftim that the Tanakh is referring to a type of model or a type of leadership called the Shofet, which is very different than the rule of kings, which appears later on Tanakh. What is the difference between a shofet, we would call a shofet a judge, but the truth is, it wouldn't really be fair to call a shofet of the Tanakh a judge, because the shofet in Sefer Shoftim, people like Dvorah and Gideon, these and Yiftach and Shimshon were much more than just judges. They were leaders. But unlike kings, they had a difference. And therefore they're called Shoftim and not kings. The question is, what is that difference? So of course, the most obvious difference between a Shofet and a Melech is that a king rules through his children. The dynasty, the idea of children continuing to the next generation and the next generation. We talk about Malchut Beit David, that Malchut Beit David is the house of David rules, while Sefer Shoftim is very, very clear in Sefer Shoftim that after the Shofet dies, a new leader is chosen. This idea of a Shofet is something that we can connect much more to in nowadays. The idea of a Shofet, it sounds very much like what we recognize or in the modern world, which is a leader cannot rule forever. And of course, when we have situations when rulers give over their leadership to their children, we have words to describe such models and in a negative way. And in Sefer Shoftim, Gideon, who was a great leader, a great ruler of his people, is the people address him and they reach out to him and they say, and you can see in front of you, they say to him, Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son. Meaning, what are they asking, in other words, right? They're asking him to be a king because he was a leader. So what's the difference? What's a chiddush now that they're asking him to be a leader? He is their leader. Aha. They're asking him to become a king. They want your son and your son's son, for you have saved them from the hand of Midian. So the first time that we have a request for kingship in Tanakh is in Sefer Shoftim at this point. Many people get confused. They think the first time that Bnei Yisrael asked for a kingship is in Sefer Shmuel, but actually it appears in Sefer Shoftim. And it is fascinating what Gideon answers to them. And Gideon said to them, I shall not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. This is a profound message of Gideon. Martin Buber, in one of his articles about this, really highlights that this message of Gideon is a very powerful idea that highlights the default in every type of kingship, leadership. Anyone who rules by default creates a problem because he is threatening Malchut HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Gideon is saying, we may need leaders in order to create a situation where there's no anarchy. We need law and order in order to survive as a society. In that, from that aspect, leadership and rulers are just a means for the people to be able to function. But Gideon was very concerned that the king would become the purpose, the aim itself. And if such is, and as such, he tells us that is an anti-Jewish idea, because we can only recognize one Melech, and that's Malko Shel Olam. So here's an irony. On one hand, it seems from Gideon's argument that leadership is not a Jewish idea because it threatens HaKadosh Baruch Hu being the ruler of the world. But at the same time, and this is the irony, it lays down the foundation for limiting the power of man, because the more power that man has to rule, the less as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has place to rule. So in some really funny, ironic way, if you understand what I'm saying right now, the foundation of limiting power, which is one of the more important, I would say, foundation kind of principles of democracy of in the Western world today, of limiting power. We call it, you know, checks and balances. We there are different methods today that we limit the power of leaders. But this idea, we do that because we're afraid that it might become a dictatorship. It might become in a situation where it will step over people's rights, meaning that is the gist, that's the idea of why we today in the Western world have checks and balances. But from a religious perspective, we get to the same conclusion, but from a theological argument. And this idea, I think, is beautifully said. I'm sorry, I don't have it translated by Rav Yehuda Shaviv. I have it here in Hebrew. I would like to read it. Wait a second. I have it here. I know I have it here. It's a long source sheet, and I apologize for its length. But here it is. Rav Yehuda Shaviv. Rav Yehuda Shaviv was a Talmid Chacham, lived in Alon Shvut, down the road from me here. He was a Rebbe in Gush when Gush first began. And he's an author of many, many articles and books, a big Talmid Chacham. And he once wrote an article about democracy and Judaism. And he basically says, in other words, what I just said now. He said, Tzurat Shilton, any type of leadership, of ruling, is a Yesh Ba Mishum Kiryat Tegar. It is a threat, Im Lo Merida, maybe even rebellion, Kineged, against the absolute Shilton, government, as if, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, he says, and here's the paradox, he says to us. The more we are able to limit the authority of government, the more we separate the government powers, the more we will be democratic, the more we will lessen we will lessen the threat of rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So as I said, we may reach the same result as we do in the Western world today, but from different perspectives. Our perspective is coming, our perspective from limiting the power of man in his ruling, in his government, comes from a religious value of the less we give man, the more we give HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that, I think, is a very profound idea with which I wanted to begin with. And from here, let's move on to the famous discussion in the Chumash and in Tanakh regarding the question, does Judaism recognize a type, a model of government? Is there an ideal government? Now, I'm sure people are aware of this matter. It's a very well-known debate and discussion. I'll just go through it really quickly. The debate is really a result of a famous contradiction that appears in the Tanakh. On one hand, in the Chumash, in Sefer, in Parashat Shoftim, in Sefer Devarim, the Torah commands us that when we come to the land of Israel, you shall appoint a king. Now, by the way, I translated "you shall appoint a king," which already is a common is giving a commentary on the pasuk, because you can translate the pasuk a little differently, which the meaning would be differently. But right now, for the sake of argument, let's just explain that the Torah commands us to appoint a king. However, when the time comes and the people turn to Shmuel HaNavi in Sefer Shmuel, and they say to him, "Shmuel, it is time for us to appoint a king." In other words, as if they're saying, "Shmuel, we are firm religious people. We want to fulfill the law of the Torah. We want to keep Hashem's word. We want to appoint a king." They get such a Musar Shmuz. They are told off. They are yelled out by Shmuel. How dare you ask for such a thing? And in Sefer Shmuel, it is not just Shmuel's opinion who is angry and condemns them, but rather HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself tells Shmuel, it's not you they don't want, it's me who they don't want. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is angry about this, which led to a very, very famous question that's so obvious. How is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upset for asking for a melech when the Torah itself commands us to do so in the Sefer Torah, in the Torah itself? Many, many reasons have been given. The Gemara itself, the Tosefta itself, already in the Mishnaic period already addresses this question and suggests that perhaps they had the wrong intentions, they didn't ask the right time. There are different answers given why perhaps there was a mistake done by the people for asking at that specific time for what they were asking for. The debate still goes on, and it's not very clear what is exactly the problem. May I suggest that the problem is exactly what we spoke about now? Meaning, and this is, I think, what the Ran seems to say, that the problem is that perhaps the people looked into a kingship as an ideal rather than into a means, as if they wanted a system to govern them, which they felt would perhaps be an ideal, which really should only be a means for governing, for living in a law and order in society. And they twisted that and felt that the king himself is the ideal. And if you do that, there is a religious problem. So it could very well be that is exactly the sin of the people, not seeing government as a means, but rather as a purpose. However, I would like to use this topic to prove, actually, that our rabbis, our teachers throughout the generations, were very, very, were very concerned to the dangers of government, of giving too much authority to people. And I just here have, I'm going to quote today, two very well-known famous opinions that I was able to get them in English. So I'm happy because it's a bit not always easy for me to find these sources in English. One of them is a very beautiful piece of the Megdavar. By the way, I spoke to Jay, to Rabbi Kelman, and we are going to be sending these source sheets later on, so people can have them later on. Right now, they're on the screen sharing in front of you. The Netziv Naftali Tzvi of Berlin, who lived in the late 19th century, he lived within the 19th century. He died at the late 19th century. The Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin and the author of many, many books, amongst them, a very, very important commentary on Chumash, he points out the language of the Torah, that the Torah refers to when it says, when you ask for a king, you shall appoint a king. The Torah uses very interesting language. The Torah doesn't tell us just, oh, you must appoint a king. The Torah uses the language, as he says here, and you shall say. What does that mean, you shall say? Ve'amarta asima alai melech. One could explain ve'amarta, you shall say, you shall appoint a king, in different ways. How does the Netziv explain it? The Netziv explains that you shall say is not just a technical matter. Oh, that when the day comes and that you shall say, I would like a king, then appoint a king. But rather, that this is a profound detail of the mitzvah of appointing a king. That the focus of appointing a king must be based upon the words of the people, the request of the people who say, we want a king. You can see here in front of you, I'll read part of it. I'll just read the last. And you shall say that the people should ask for it, and then you shall appoint a king. Meaning, according to the Netziv, the idea that the people are involved in the process of appointing a king, that the government of the people comes from the people, by the people. I know I'm using some kind of words here that are well known. But the idea that it's the people who are part of the process, and that at the end of the day, the king of Israel was only appointed when the people wanted the king. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself in the Torah points out that Ve'amarta asima alai melech, it has to do with the people, already tells us that the place of the will of the people in deciding who their leader will be is a very, very important piece of leadership of government. That, of course, is one of the more important principles I think of democracy, which is that the government, of course, is a reflection of the will of the people. This, according to the Netziv, is already an idea that the Torah refers to in the words Ve'amarta Asima Alai Melech. I'm sure people are aware of the very well-known idea of the Abarbanel. I'm just going to repeat it. I have it on the source sheet. I'll go back there in a second. But Yitzhak Don Abarbanel, the famous advisor to King Fernando and Queen Isabella, I will say Yimach Shemam, who expelled the Jews of Spain in 1492. He was there, famously, he was their advisor, and after the conquest of Spain from the Muslims and throwing out all the Muslims from Spain, the Spaniards wanted to kick out all the Jews. As we all know, the expulsion of Spain in 1492 occurred, and Abarbanel had to himself leave the country. Even though he was offered to stay in this country, he preferred to join his people and go on exile. The Abarbanel, as you know, was a very famous commentator on Chumash and Navi, one of the greatest in Jewish history. And there's no question that when he refers to this discussion that we're discussing right now, to the discussion of what is the ideal in the Torah when it comes to a king, to a government, there is no question that he is referring directly, even writes it explicitly, he's referring to the monarchy of his time, to the governments of his time. He really knew kings. He lived in the palaces of kings. He met them. He talked to them. He advised them, not only, by the way, in Spain, but also later on in Naples and Italy. He also had relationships and connections to kings and queens. And there's no question that in his commentary, he's reflecting in a very negative way his opinion of the monarchy. And Abarbanel already over 500 years ago is laying down in his writings certain principles and ideas that we would find that one could compare very, very easily to democratic principles that we find today in our governments of today. Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel really understood that the Torah does not believe in monarchy. And when the Torah does command us, it does not do it in a positive way, but almost in a, not negative, but, well, if that's what you want, then that's what you do. I'll give you an example. We have other mitzvot in the Torah that are mitzvot, and yet everyone understands that there's no idea that one should always run to do them. I'll give you an example that I think we're all familiar with. Getting divorced. The Torah has a mechanism called divorce. If lo aleinu, a couple something happens in the marriage and they have to separate, the Torah recognizes that there is a mechanism of divorce, giving a get. Does anyone think that this is a mitzvah that we should all try to keep? Is this something positive that we should all try to do? No, it's a mechanism within the Torah that if this situation comes up, this is how you must perform. This is how you must act. This is the way the Torah teaches you how to perform under these circumstances. We have other examples like this, war, and the Torah teaches us how to fight a war. Obviously, no one's going to say, "Oh, I wish to keep all mitzvot. I hope I can also perform mitzvot of war." No, it's obvious that a war is something that we don't want to do. We prefer not going to war. But if Chas v'Shalom we go to war, then the Torah teaches us this is how to perform a war. In a similar way, the Abarbanel understands that the mitzvah of appointing a king is not necessarily something so positive that we should all run to do, but rather, in the circumstances where we need to govern, okay, what can you do? You need to appoint a king. But going back to what we said before, it's not an ideal of itself, but rather a means of governing the people, so we shouldn't have a problem with law and order and anarchy. And within that commentary that he writes, he really tells us something quite amazing. I'm going to read it out loud, and it's in front of you. It is not impossible for a nation to have many leaders who gather together, unite, and agree upon a single policy. Why shouldn't their leadership extend for a year or for 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, or less than that? You hear that? The Abarbanel highlights the problem with having one person who is a dictator. Isn't it good for us to have more opinions? Isn't it more healthy for us to limit the amount of years that a person should rule. The model of a monarchy where someone has so much power and he has no his power is such a powerful kingship that he rules till he dies, really gives him so much power. And he explains, and look what he says here. I'm skipping a little bit. He says here, surely experience overrides reasoning. Look and see those countries governed by kings. And today we see countries governed by judges and temporary rulers elected from among them. This is in 1490s and 1480s. Now under the elected governments, there is nothing crooked or perverse. No man raises his hand or foot to commit a crime. And they conquer countries with wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. So Abarbanel is already 500 years ago suggesting that we rethink the models of monarchy and that we should be challenging the classic models of monarchy which exist in Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years of total control over the people and passing on from generation to generation. In other words, that Barbanel suggests we adopt the model of a shofet rather than a model of a king. Here, he is not mentioning so much the theological problem that we mentioned before, but rather he is telling us that this is this is asking for trouble. This is asking for corruption, for dictatorship, for really a king stepping on the rights of people, and therefore. We should rethink this model of monarchy. And therefore, he says, the Torah does not necessarily believe in the model of kingship as the pshat of the Torah does seem to say, but rather, it's not an ideal, but rather a means. And therefore, in every generation, one should rethink the ideal model for government. So here is a really terrific and really quite amazing idea already hundreds of years ago that Torah scholars are suggesting alternative models that sound much more democratic than the classic monarchy. Let's move forward. By the way, I'm sorry, but I people are asked. I saw maybe people wrote something on the chat. I will. I do attend. I do intend to give the last 10 minutes for people to ask and to comment, to argue, to say, you know, this is a democracy here today, so you can voice your opinions and question and comment. So we'll leave the last few minutes of the shiur for that. But I would like to move forward right now and suggest other models that exist within our sources that do. Are very similar to certain values in the democratic world. And here I'm moving forward to a well-known idea that appears in the Ramban and Sefer Bereshit. The Ramban and Sefer Bereshit, towards the end of Chumash Bereshit, Parashat Vayechi, in the Brachot of Yaakov to his children, the Ramban refers to the promise of Yaakov lo yasu shevet miyuda. There's a very well-known argument amongst the Mefarshim, the commentators on this pasuk, whether or not Yaakov before his death, when he gives over these blessings to his children, are these some kind of prophecies, or are they more what we would call mitzvot, commandments? How do we really look at the words of Yaakov is debatable amongst the poskim. And this actually refers to his blessing to Yehuda to receive the kingship. Lo yasur shevet miyuda. In other words, the shevet, the rule, the shevet is a staff. So it's some kind of a ruling staff that the king had in his hand. And Yaakov is telling the brothers that he decided that the king of Israel will come from the tribe of Judea. As we know, Malchut Beit David will come out of Shevet Yehuda. And according to the Ramban, this is not just a prophecy, but rather a commandment that we can only have kings from Shevet Yehuda, and any type of kingship that threatens Malchut Beit David is going against the Torah. This, of course, correct this, of course, if that's true, then we have a big question about how is it possible that Shaul was the first king of Israel? Not only was he the first king of Israel, but he was appointed by Kadosh Baruch Hu. How could it be that Kadosh Baruch Hu, who teaches us that Malchut Beit David is the chosen king, suddenly decides to take someone from a different tribe? That's a very well-known question, and I'm not going to talk about this right now. I'm sorry, this is really off our topic. But the Ramban explains that this was a terrible sin of the Chashmonaim. There are famous theories in question. Why is it that there is no Mishnah about Hanukkah? We have about on Purim, we have a whole book in the Mishnah, Masechet Megillah. We have Masechet in Shas, Masechet Megillah, all about the laws of Purim. We even have a book in the Tanakh, Megillat Esther. Why is it that Hanukkah does not have a book in the Tanakh and doesn't have a book in the Mishnah? Can people hear me? Are we good? Okay, sorry. I thought maybe someone was frozen there. That's a very famous question. Some suggest, and this is not, again, not my topic. Just want to mention it. Some suggest that it's because Chazal were very upset at the Chashmonaim. That even though they were very, they recognized the miracle that occurred during the Hasmonean period with the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash and the Chazara Malchut Yisrael, the sovereignty of Israel at the time where we came back to Beit HaMikdash and we had some kind of freedom and sovereignty. However, some suggest that Chazal were not very happy with the Chashmonaim. Why? Well, here is where the Ramban comes in and says something quite amazing. The Ramban is telling us that the Chashmonai family sinned. Why? Because they became kings. And the Chashmonaim, of course, were Kohanim. They were priests from the tribe of Levi. And as such, were prohibited from becoming kings. Only people from the tribe of Judea are permitted to become kings. How dare the Chashmonaim become kings? And we know that the sons of Shimon, the son of Matityahu, he was a king, and they became kings till Churban Beit HaMikdash. It was 200 years that the descendants of the Chashmonaim family were kings. So this is a very well-known Ramban. It's a fascinating idea. However, what's more fascinating for our discussion is what the Ramban adds to their sin. He says it's not only their sin for challenging the tribe of Judea, but here, look what he says here. It is also possible that in addition to the Hasmoneans having sinned for assuming royal, they sinned in ruling on account of their being priests who have been commanded, guard your priesthood and everything that pertains to the altar. Thus, it was not for them to rule, but only to perform the service of God. Is this not the closest thing that you can find to separation of church and state in our sources? The Ramban is telling us it's not only that they threatened Shevet Yehuda and became kings when they weren't allowed to. It's also because of who they were. They were Shevet Levi, they were Kohanim. Their responsibility as Kohanim were to be leaders in the religious sphere. They were supposed to be the rabbis and the educators and the teachers. And by them stepping over, as if, stepping over from their responsibility into government, they basically made a salad. They made a mix or a challenge, right, of what they were supposed to be doing. They mixed two different sects of government, two branches of government. One is the religious branch of I don't know if government, but of a branch within Judaism of religion, and they mixed it together with government. And that, says the Ramban, is no less perhaps of a sin, and why God punished the Chashmonai family and ensured that they would have no descendants. That's a very, very serious allegation and of the Ramban. Some really argue that this Ramban is, I wouldn't say is exactly the modern idea of separation between church and state, because really that is a very long idea to us to discuss. If we were to ask what is ideal of the Torah regarding separation and church and state, I think that would require a very long discussion and talk. The models that we have today, for example, in America versus, let's say, England or France, which are very different models of how state and religion are connected or not connected, I don't think any of them would fit the ideal model of Judaism. However, the idea that there is such a danger and a concern and a worry is what the Ramban is suggesting. What is the ideal? Not for now. I don't know right now what the ideal is. I'm not going to talk about it right now. But are we aware that there's a danger? Yes, we are aware. The Ramban already says that 800 years ago. I don't care so much what people think today in Israel regarding what is the ideal. But I think we are all aware of the dangers when we mix politics and religion. Again, what is the solution today? In today's, I'm sure if we go around the room right now, we will hear many different opinions and we all have different suggestions. But I think that we are all aware. And we can see it de facto. We can see it the past few years. I think that it's quite proven that when we mix religion and politics, the results are really not so good. And this already is an idea of the Ramban. As I said before, here's another very important principle of the Western democratic principles, which I think Judaism feels very, very, very comfortable with. Okay, let's continue. We don't have much more time. We don't have much time, but I would like to really in 5 minutes just go to maybe move to a totally different area, which unfortunately we don't have much time to talk about. But this is really a question regarding the legal system of the State of Israel. Does the Torah, does the halakha, Jewish law, does it recognize a judicial system which does not follow the laws of the Torah? I have to tell you that the truth that this is one of the more difficult challenges for an Orthodox Jew that believes in the state, that loves the state, that recognizes the greatness of this Jewish state that we live in. I would say that in so many areas, it's very easy for us to accept certain ideas that don't always go together with our faith and our beliefs. However, in this matter, it is a much more sensitive matter. Can a firm Jew accept a system that rules by British or Turkish law and not by Torah law? Now, I have to say something very, very simple here before we start. This is a huge topic, and I don't have much time to talk about it. But I will tell you that there's a certain dissonance that exists between the principle of this discussion to the way it's actually practiced here in Israel. And I'll explain what I mean. In practice, there are many, many frum, Orthodox, Yirei Shamayim, lawyers and judges in Israel. Here I live in Alon Shvut, and we have in Alon Shvut, I can't even count how many judges we have that live in where I live. We have a Supreme Court justice that lives in Alon Shvut down the road from me. We have my old chavruta. I have two chavrutas from yeshiva that are judges today here in the courts of Israel, and we're all very proud of it. And some of my best friends are even lawyers. Meaning, in practice, there are many from Jews that are in the legal system. However, there's a big dissonance between the practice and the theory of if one were to go to the sources and articles that were written about whether or not it is a simple thing to accept The answer is no, it's not. In all the writings, almost all the writings of great modern Orthodox Zionist rabbis since 1948 on this matter, there is hardly anyone that really embraces the legal system that we know today, because, very simply, because many times it goes against the ruling of the Torah. I must add something very important here. We must differentiate and separate between what we call between dinei mamonot, monetary matters, disputes amongst neighbors and friends, to what we call criminal law. What I mean is, in the world of criminal law, there's no dispute. In the world of criminal law, in theft, murder, rape, lo aleinu, in those areas, if tomorrow morning there would be a religious government that would go a that would follow the Torah in every matter, I don't believe that much would change to what we have today in Israel. We would still have jails. We would still put people in jail for theft, rape, and murder. We would still use the same laws that we have. We would not be going back to the laws of the Torah in these matters. I don't have the time to explain why, but that's very clear to me, and that's very clear to everyone. The area in which it becomes very, very problematic is dinei mamonot, monetary law. For example, the laws of lending money and disputes between neighbors. In those matters, we have Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra. We have the Choshen Mishpat, the Shulchan Aruch, the Shach. We have an entire bookcase of Jewish law, which, by the way, is very practical and very relevant to our days. It can be, it's no less practical and relevant than English law that was also written in the 12th century. And in every generation, they also talked about oxes and mules hundreds of years ago. And now they talk about cars and people in the modern world. So does our Torah. Our Torah, our Choshen Mishpat, our Shulchan Aruch, is as adaptable as any system in the world. And for a firm Jew, this really creates a very big challenge. How is it possible for us to adopt an alternative legal system to our Torah? Now, the history of what happened in 1948 is fascinating. I'll just tell you that people like Rav Herzog, Chief Rabbi Herzog, who is the grandfather of the current president of Israel, really tried so hard to convince the leaders, the Zionist leaders in the late 40s and the early 50s. He tried to convince them to adopt Torah laws in the monetary department. He really tried to somehow, he had suggestions of how to translate these laws in modern times and to bring them into our systems. He really was he was very disappointed, of course, when it didn't work out. But he really, I think he should be remembered as a great pioneer in this department, who really tried. He wrote a lot about this. He has a book about this. He articles about this. He really tried, but he failed. So I don't have the time right now or to really go into all the different discussions, different models that exist within our law to suggest how we would be able perhaps to create models that we can live with. I will say, though, that a modern Orthodox Zionist Jew that lives in Israel today really has a dissonance in this department. On one hand, we recognize the fact that A, we don't live in a state where everyone is religious, so we have to we recognize that it's impossible and wrong to pass religious laws, but to change the legal system today in a country where people are not interested in doing so. We understand the importance of having rules in order to create law and order and chas v'shalom not to have anarchy. But on the other hand, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to us to give it some kind of credit and importance and hierarchy, which it doesn't deserve, because really it's an alternative to the systems that, according to Torah laws, we should have. There are big arguments, you should know, there are big arguments for years going on within religious judges, religious lawyers, and religious professors of law. One of my closest friends is a professor of law in Hebrew University in this department, in this area. There's a big argument going on for years whether or not we should try, we, the religious community, should try to somehow add to the secular law system laws that are Torah-based laws, and somehow to infiltrate the system and to connect it. There's arguments about this, whether or not it's correct or not correct. We should try or not try. Again, this is a huge topic, but I just wanted to say that in this matter, there is a bit of a challenge, and not so simple for a firm Jew to really accept the model that exists today. So if we sum up what we said today, I said that the modern Orthodox Zionist Jew living in Israel today does not have to apologize as if and be threatened or be feeling uncomfortable when we talk about democratic and Western values. Many of these values, many of these ideas already exist within the Torah. To say that we have no other value system but democracy, of course, is foolish, because the Torah, of course, creates for us other values as well. And most importantly, the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our authority is, of course, the main point here. But as I said, there's no reason for a person to feel threatened and uncomfortable when faced as a firm Jew with values. And I believe with all my heart that many, if not most, of the way the government today here in Israel exists in theory. I'm not talking about the political, the politics. I'm talking about the structure and the idea. For sure, has religious value as well, because our Torah does believe in government and governing and sovereignty as principles and rules, and there's no conflict or contradiction between Torah values and government. So that thing is, however, as I said, when it comes to the legal systems, this is a little bit more of a difficult challenge for us today, of how we can live as if with such systems, even though de facto we actually live with them quite comfortably, and we're part of the system. So how does that work exactly? That is a bit more difficult. I know I said I would give time for questions, but please, if people have comments or questions, we have a few minutes. This year is really basically over now. But I'm offering, suggesting, and offering people, if they want to comment or to ask questions, now would be a great time to. Bakasha. Okay. That's fine if no one has what to say. I just want to mention that, please God, next week we will continue this series by talking about 1538, the request to create a Sanhedrin in Sfat, which will happen again in 1948, and we will talk about this will continue our discussion whether or not it's possible to create a system, a legal system that goes by the Torah in modern times, and we will use a case study of 1538 in Sfat as our example to question the authority of rabbis then and today in creating a legal system of authority of rabbis that could actually rule and in legal matters. So that will be B'ezrat Hashem next week's lesson. I wish you all a
Question,
yes.
please. Yes, not according to the Nitziv, the Abarbanel, but according, for example, to the Rambam, and those who say that appointing a king is a mitzvah, not an if the people first asked. Why did it take over 400 years from the time that Bnei Israel came into Eretz Israel for a king to be appointed?
The answer might be that these things take time. That the tribes were we talk about today about Israel being 75 years old, and we're still going through some kind of hevlei leidah. We're still trying to figure out who we are and what we are. These things take quite time for people to. I'm just guessing, but my guess is as good as yours. That this is something that took just a lot of time till they figured it out. They tried different models. Maybe they thought that perhaps Shoftim is a better challenge. Let's not forget that throughout Sefer Shoftim, they're still fighting to live in the. I mean, their mind is still in trying to establish a sovereignty, a government. People will say that here in Israel, why are we arguing about this only today? Because for the past 75 years, we've just been fighting for our existence, and we never had the opportunity to really dwell upon these matters and to really question where we're going next. Some people will say that it takes 75 years for the state of Israel for people to actually think about the next step. Perhaps the same idea happened to Sefer Yehoshua and Shoftim. It's battle after battle after battle, fighting after fighting. When did the Jews really get the first sense of peace? That's only in the day of Shlomo HaMelech. In the day of Shlomo HaMelech, there's some kind of idea of peace. Maybe it takes time, but that's my guess. Nazar has their hand up.
Yeah, I have a question. Did the legal system of Israel ever thought about creating a separate category for frum people versus chiloni? So the frum people go by their own laws and the system kind of accepts that.
Yeah, there are religious courts for monetary disputes. Today in Israel, if you have a, by the way, but you have that, by the way, in Chutzlars too. If you today live in I don't know, in Cleveland, Ohio, or I don't know, New York, and you have a dispute with your fellow Jew, you can go to a rabbinical court in America as well today, or in Canada, I don't know, wherever in England, and go to a court and settle it before rabbis that will judge and rule by Torah law. In Israel, we have these kind of courts. They're actually recognized by the state of Israel, and they have authority. But you can't force someone to go to it. You can force someone to go to a legal court in Israel, but you can't force him to go to a rabbinical court. The only authority that rabbinical courts do have in Israel, by the way, are in matters of marriage. In marriage and divorce, the secular courts have no authority. The rabbinical courts have authority. Any Chiloni Jew who wants to get married must go through the rabbinical court. So that's actually quite fascinating. Right or wrong, that's the situation right now.
Okay, thank you.
B'seder, everyone. Have a Shabbat Shalom. I hope that here in Israel we see more peace. I'm sure everyone is praying with us to see peace in our home, and all the prisoners, B'ezrat Hashem, come home quickly. In good health, and all our soldiers, all the hostages, of course, and the soldiers return safely, B'ezrat Hashem. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Yitraot.